Welcome back to On Call with Insignia, where we go on call with leaders innovating the future of Southeast Asia's internet and digital economy, or as we like to call it, ASI Innovation. Today, we have on call Aaron Tan, CEO and co-founder of Caro, Southeast Asia's leading car marketplace. Aaron has been on the show before, actually, on a panel to share learnings from steering Caro through the early onset of the pandemic. We've also had the opportunity to talk to the leaders of Caro, from their head of tech to CMO and CFO. This time, we've invited Aaron back to share his own perspective, being at the helm of Singapore's fastest growing company and driving it into the future. Let's dial into his call with Inglan. Inglan, take it away.
Hey, thanks, Paulo. Aaron, thanks for the show again. I think there has been very exciting developments on Caro's front, and I'm happy to give you a chance to update this. I've known Aaron for a long time. He's been an entrepreneur since he was 18 years old, or even younger. And you know, now Caro is a very formidable marketplace dominating in the automobile space in Southeast Asia. There's also a lot of development on the AI front. So Aaron, why don't you give us an update on Caro? The last time we had you was back in early December with Ernest, your CFO. Why don't you give us, our listeners, a quick recap about the exciting things that Caro has been up to in the past quarter?
No, thanks for having me, Inglan. So, you know, for us, again, we are Southeast Asia's largest leading retail auto marketplace. And, you know, hopefully as a group, over the last year itself, you know, the company has grown more than two times, right? Actually, year on year, pre-COVID to now. And in fact, this year, we are forecasting to end the year at somewhere north of 200,000 units at least by the end of this coming financial year. Right. And you know, a lot of the growth really has to do with the fact that we are focusing a lot more on B2C sales, basically selling, providing customers with the Amazon.com kind of experience for vehicles. Right. So what we're trying to do really at the end of the day is to offer our customers, especially the retail customers, an experience like almost buying an iPhone online or buying a tissue paper box online. Right. So much so that all you need to do is just view the vehicles online, go through our process internally online again, you know, be it to fill up for the details to submit for a bank loan, down towards insurance, warranties, yada, yada. And then, you know, selecting when you want a car to be delivered to your doorstep, right? So it's making it dumbed down to a process whereby it's so simple, whereby anyone can buy a car online with just a few clicks. And that's how we tend to think about the future of the purchase of cars and stuff like that. And all this really, you know, a lot of what we do over the last year itself, really to double down, triple down into our spend in technology, especially in areas such as AI, machine learning stuff. And I guess more importantly, even within our own people, making sure that we brought on right people into the team. Recently, we just brought on a nuclear scientist, if you may, to really help lead and supercharge our efforts in the data science, computer vision, magnetic resonance field. And we are very, very happy about the progress of the company over the past year. And I think, you know, moving forward this coming particular year, we are super excited because we feel that the company will gain potential to grow more than three times what it did last year. And again, you know, thanks for having me today on this.
One of the key themes that you're pushing for in 2021 is focusing more on AI, right? And I think AI has been key to Caro's value proposition since early on. But I think it's become like front and center with your AI powered insurance and customer service talk bots and some of your recent hires. How do you see the role of artificial intelligence in Caro's operation and overall user experience the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, and that's something that actually I think about constantly every day almost, right? You know, the way I think about this is that I want to allow, you know, consumers, especially really end retail consumers, I'm not talking about so much, you know, the business owners, I mean, other small businesses, but more of the real end consumer retailers, to buy a car entirely online, right? And if you think about the whole process itself today, is pretty broken, all right? And for us, it's all about how do we ensure a more positive customer experience, right? Let me give you some examples on this, right? So I think, you know, when we think about the steps that an individual has to go through, let's not even talk about the pain, right? Of like, you know, identifying the cars, down towards even things like going down, driving down to look at the car, sometimes test driving, yada, yada, stuff like that. But let's just look at the whole experience, right? So assuming that you identify the car that you want, right? The vehicle of your dreams. You typically go down there and then, you know, you have to deal with a lot of things ranging from, you know, questions about the vehicles itself down towards things like the insurance, the financing, the trade-in value of the vehicle, down again towards when do you want a car delivered? And there's many other steps in between, right? But for us, we break down the steps, right? So, you know, most recently, we just announced that, you know, we have been doing a lot of this outbound and inbound calls using AI. And what does that mean? That effectively means that, you know, when a customer calls us or when we call a customer, now instead of, you know, hiring an army of people for customer service or sales, we actually use machines to do that, right? So the machines will be able to understand and then extrapolate the question that you want to ask. And for that matter, then respond to you. And the whole process just doesn't sound like a machine talking to you. It really sounds like a human talking, all right? And that's how we want to change the whole sales process, right? Now imagine how scalable that business is. Now, if you look deeper into like even trade-ins, that our core bread and butter of the business really is that, you know, we are able to take your car in instantly, right? Given any car make model and details of the vehicle, we can give you the pricing of the cars instantly. And that effectively means that, you know, we are able to trade in, take in your cars in as little as a few seconds, right? And for that matter, then pay you off. Now, if you look at then, you know, where machine learning or AI comes into play, right? That has got to do with pricing algorithms, right? You know, how do we ensure that the pricing of the cars are accurate in real time? And so for us to be able to then provide you with that. Or even, you know, deeper things like, you know, credit, right? So a lot of the credits that we do before, even sometimes we do sell the credits to the banks, right? But the truth is that a lot of it is done internally, right? So in-house, right, we have credit systems that we have built, again, using machine learning, right? We build credit models that actually allows us to understand what is the quality of the customers. Now, assuming your credit is okay, then the question is more like, okay, you know, how can we get more accurate in terms of like, you know, do we know the car we're selling? You know, is it safe? Is it a good quality car? Has a car been flooded? Has a car been mileage tempered and stuff like that? And a lot of what we do today really is to diagnose the cars using machine learning. Let me give you some examples of it, right? So today, you know, already if you're a customer, whenever you submit the vehicles and stuff and whatnot, actually the machines will look through the vehicle, I mean, the pictures that you uploaded, and then in real time, be able to detect all the scratches and dents and, you know, any cosmetic imperfections, right, of the vehicles itself. And, you know, we do this entirely through machine trained models, right? And similarly, we know we make use of magnetic resonance techniques, basically sound, right, to actually further tell us what's happening in the vehicles itself, right? So all I can say is that, you know, the net of this is we really use AI, right, machine learning more specifically in every facet of the consumer experience when they're trying to buy or sell the vehicle, right? Whether or not they're trying to buy a car from us, whether or not we are trying to sell a car to them or for that matter, take their cars in as trade-in. Machine learning or AI is really throughout the entire phase of what we do, right? And internally, you know, we are almost 1,000 people now across mainly 4 countries, but I would dare say that's a number that I'm not super proud of, right? But again, as a tech company, as a company that is really driven by machine learning and data science stuff, we really want, you know, that number to be as low as possible, right? In fact, I always tell my investors, if I can 1/3 that number, right? So basically go from 1,000 people to 300 people, that'd be ideal, right? If I have a choice, again, half the companies, if not more, should be data scientists, programmers, engineers. And we want this to be, you know, a platform by itself whereby it's scalable, you know, using machine learning and tech and stuff like that. And we think by far, you know, we definitely have the best team and for that matter, the best pedigree to be able to achieve something like this.
Oh, fantastic. I think I want to double click on some of your investments in AI, which really has seen a lot of progress in the past 12, 15 months. How do you prioritize some of the application and use cases they've developed within Caro?
Yeah, so for me, a lot of it is what is the business telling me, right? Like for instance, you know, we go internally a lot of times. Actually, AI for us is less of money making in that sense versus cost saving, right? So there's a bit of both, but let me explain, right? So one of the things that we prioritize a lot is computer vision stuff, right? Because, you know, we realize very quickly that our mechanics will take somewhere north of about 30, 45 minutes to literally inspect every car, right? So the question for us is that, hey, how can we lower the time taken it is, right? By just getting anybody literally to upload the pictures of the vehicles, and then the machine can immediately tell you what are the exact imperfections of the cars in seconds, right? And you know, by one full sweep of doing this, we get to wipe out, first of all, the need to hire mechanics as and when we expand, right? And by the way, it's not super expensive to hire mechanics, right? And that's not the issue. The issue is about standardized reports, right? So we realize very quickly, you know, if you run a skilled business like ours, you realize very quickly that if you have humans trying to do inspections and stuff like that, the humans might have a bad day, right? They might have quarreled with the wife the day before. And then as a result, his inspection, you know, might deviate a lot, right? Inspector to inspector, day to day. Well, the machines doesn't need that. The machine doesn't really have like emotions and whatnot that you have to take care of. You don't have to deal with, you know, rostering and stuff and whatnot. So there's a lot of this byproduct of using lesser people, but I think what's more interesting is to upgrade the skill sets of the people, right? Now, instead of taking the pictures and being that operation system itself, you know, you enable the machines, right? And then the machines will help you do that in the order of magnitude lesson. And come back to your question, Inglan, how do we prioritize it? Really, at the end of the day, it's a business case, right? So in this case, quite clearly, if we can get an inspection time from 45 minutes down to 45 seconds, we should definitely do something here. It's 100x difference, right? Or even things like, okay, machine learning pricing algorithms, right? We spend a lot of time understanding exactly how much we should buy a car in and stuff like that, because that has a lot to do with our top line and bottom line. And today we remain, the only automotive marketplace transactional ones at least that is at scale and profitable, right? So, you know, like in fact, for the last 2 years, we have been EBITDA positive, and I'm always glad to say that we've been able to achieve this because of the fact that, you know, we don't need to spend as much as our competitors do. And I have been able to do this at a very, very good pace, so to speak. Yeah, and it all has to do with the fact that it's machine learning driven. But there you go, right? It's primarily two things. Number one, I would say again, you know, what is the business case, right? What's the cost savings? Now, if it's not cost saving, then the question is as simple as, okay, how much money would that make me, right? That's how we prioritize it. And there's a dollar value attached to it.
Right. Thanks for sharing your insights on AI in Karo. One of the key things that I forgot to congratulate you was Karo was just voted the fastest growing company in Singapore for the past year. And all the big things you've been driving is consumer focus and B2C. And a huge part of that is building a robust sales organization. How do you think about doing that, building such a sales organization across multiple markets in the region, especially during the pandemic?
Yeah, no, that's very important. I mean, the good thing for us is that we have been doing B2C now over the last couple of years, right? And in fact, more than 23% of our revenues today already is B2C related. And a lot of it has to do with the importance of building a sales organization and enforcing a sales culture, right, internally. And I want to say that, you know, we have not sorted that out entirely. I can't claim that, you know, we have built out the strongest sales organization. I always think that there's room for us to improve, especially against the pandemic and stuff like that. The good thing, though, is that we have sort of like identified a few things and stuff. But for me, you know, building a sales organization comes down to actually a lot of carrot and stick and also a lot of tracking between, right? So I think the first thing is about rewarding for performance, right? And making sure that you also hire fast, fire faster, right? So our sales part of staff, I think the net of this is that we subscribe to the belief of like, if you can't perform, then you should leave, right? So I think that's how we tend to think about this. And then of course, if you perform well standpoint, we will then reward you accordingly, hence the carrot and stick analogy, right? The last part I want to say about building a strong sales organization at the end of the day really is down to tracking, right? So, you know, for us, we invest a lot of time, money, and efforts into data science. And for that matter, more data analytics in this case, right? Internally, we have Tableau systems and data studio systems and whatnot that we set up to view. And, you know, literally to tell us what's the health and condition of the company in real time. And, you know, as again, as a sales organization or a company that wants to build a strong sales organization, that's super important because you do need to be able to act on numbers really, really quickly. The last part I would say also is that, you know, is this relentless focus on customer satisfaction, right? Internally, what we call NPS, of course, net promoter scores and stuff and whatnot. So we spend a lot of our time, money, and effort really to solicit feedback from customers to understand, are they happy with their service? If they're not, you know, we need to move faster than, you know, than they're being unhappy, so to speak. So these three things that I just outlined are things that I would say that is super critical for us to try to build really a strong sales organization across Southeast Asia.
Oh, that's great. You know, Aaron, it's been an honor serving on the board of Karo for a couple of years now. And it's really breathtaking to see Karo grow from a company of few people to now almost 1,000, or actually across 1,000. So I'd like to shift the conversation to involving the leadership team. You've done a great job finding the right executives to fill up key position of departments and country level leadership, something I'm a big fan of. What has been your approach to finding the right people? What advice do you have for other founders, CEOs? And we have a lot of them in the audience looking for C-suite or senior leadership hires as they expand.
Sounds good. You know, the way I think about this is number one, you know, it's all about looking for people that can complement your skills, right? So, you know, for myself, I think that I'm pretty good technically, right? So half the team from us, you know, internally, we are either programmers by training, you know, from Carnegie Mellon, Cambridge, etc., right? But you know, one thing we found that has been amazing is that we have people like Helen, for instance, who is currently still the head of my multi-finance business itself, right? She brings with her a wealth of experience in the debt in the sector itself, right? So the thing when we first got her on board really was that we felt that, okay, we need someone really with deep, strong domain expertise, right? And in this case, we found a friend in Helen, right? Because she quite clearly knows her stuff, right? That's where we can come in and say that, hey, we can complement her by injecting tech into the multi-finance business itself and vice versa, right? You know, she can compliment us by the fact that, you know, she can inject her domain expertise into us and stuff and whatnot. I would also say, you know, to a certain extent, the age doesn't really matter, right? At the end of the day, it's really just, it's down to the chemistry between the founders itself, right? So I always try to get my other co-founders or for that matter, other people in the management team to interview other management teams, right? So the second thing I would say is actually a lot to do with chemistry, right? And you want to make sure that you bring someone on board that your other fellow early co-founders or management team can work with. And I think that's actually super critical by itself. All right. And the third thing really at the end of the day is that is to bring someone that is hungry. All right. You know, I always say this, which is Helen by itself, she's more than 60 years old, but I feel that she can run faster than any of the 30-year-old, you know, or 20 plus years old in the company. Right. I don't mean it too literally, but you know, that hunger, that passion, that aggression is something that, you know, money cannot buy. And that's something that I feel has been critical for us, you know, when we try to hire a management team. I look back and I ask myself, you know, what has been the hit and misses? And half the time, if I were to miss on that, it's mainly because I feel that the candidate himself lacks this particular ingredient, right? You can be the best at what you do. You can be the most complimentary to our team. you can get along well with us. But then at the end of the day, you are not driven by numbers. You are not number driven yourself. You lack the motivation. You do not have hunger. That's not going to work, right? So I think the net, these are the three things, again, I would say that are super critical for you to look out for, especially when you make management hires.
That's great. You know, at Insignia, we have a saying called unstoppable, right? So if you are hungry, you know, no obstacle is too big. You know, I wanted to go back to the business, the Caro business. And I love for you to share the audience what you learned in the past 5 years, looking back. And where do you see the company going forward in the next 5 years?
Oh, I've learned a lot of things. I mean, the question is so broad, but let me just bring it into what have I learned as a CEO, I guess. From a CEO standpoint, I feel that your most important assets in the company is not even investors. Your most important assets are actually your people, right? So, you know, one thing we learn very quickly in the company really is the fact that we need to continuously reinvest in our people to keep our people around and stuff and whatnot, right? So I think that's something that I feel has been very important for us and very integral to where we have been, right? So if you look at just headcount management or even middle management people, we have been having the same people for the last few years, right? Most of them have been around for at least 2-3 years. And that's pretty good from my standpoint, right? So, but it's all about how do we retain talent? How do we make sure that people want to join us? How do we invest more into HRs and stuff like that? And I think that's something that if I learn, and if I reflect upon myself over the last few years, I think that's something that we are doing okay well. I think that's something that we can do a lot better, right? Which is, you know, manage people, manage expectations, help bring the right people into the organization, inculcating the whole culture. You know, people always talk about culture, but the truth is that no one can really give you a very good definition of what exactly is a culture and how to build culture, so to speak. But internally, you know, I feel that that's something that is pretty big in us in that sense. You know, we focus a lot about how do we bring the right people on board? How do we make sure that the people we bring on board are the same with all of us and stuff like that? And a lot has to do with holding this whole particular culture and stuff like that. So yeah, so, you know, really one of the many things that I learned, again, as CEO of the company is that managing 100 people is quite different from managing 1,000 people. And you should try to build up that organization sooner rather than later, right? Rather than leave the problem to I'll wait for it 2-3 years down the road. We should start build systems in place, build employment practices in place so that, you know, your organization can scale. That to me is super critical. I think one other thing I learned about things are also investors, right? So, you know, investors itself, again, we have to count our blessings because we have very strong supporters like yourself, England, on the team. And if anything at all, one of the things that I again, when I look back, it's super important to have the right investors that believe in your vision and your dream, right, in building the business, because it's not something that you can build overnight. You need years, many, many years of waiting and stuff like that. And again, congratulations. I think you have an IPO coming up soon, but that was many years in the making, right? So for us, we need to look for like-minded people, or otherwise, you know, life is too short for you to deal with investors that doesn't understand what you're trying to do and then keep giving you problems and pressure and stuff and whatnot, which is unnecessary, right? So I think the number two thing I would say really is the importance of choosing the right investor sets and stuff like that. And I must say that one, we have done okay well. Again, you know, I think that's something that's super important. The third thing I would say is also financial discipline. We have particularly, I think, the word is that we have purposely stuck towards the idea of being EBITDA positive and EBITDA neutral. Half the time, whenever investors look at my books, they'll say that, hey, how come you are EBITDA neutral, right? Or for that matter, you're EBITDA positive. Where else your competition in the other markets are doing far off that, right? Why are they burning so much money? I think it has more to do with discipline, with the idea of that, hey, you know, it's important to look for product market fit before you even try to expand beyond too much, right? Because trying to spend money or burning VC money is very irresponsible. And then at the same time, you know, you probably will end up subsidizing the market too much and, you know, stay irrelevant in that sense, right? So one thing, again, if I look back, one of the many best strategic decisions that I have, I still remember sometimes 3 years ago, 4 years ago, one of the earliest investors asked me, you know, Aaron, it's good that you are EBITDA positive on certain months, but, you know, do you really need to be EBITDA positive? I said, yes, right? And voila, 3 years later, you know, we made definitely a right call, right? Again, the company has been EBITDA positive for last year and this year. So it is testament to, number one, that we are really running a business here. We're not just running any other tech business. We actually have a path to making money. And that has been super critical and actually very positive for us as we're trying to fundraise in this particular environment. Now, if you ask me again, you know, the next 5 years, where do I see Caro and stuff like that? I mean, I look at this honestly as we will probably be a public company by then, all right? You know, for us as a company, we would have definitely be well over $1 billion in valuation for sure. All right. And I think that's where we want the company to be, right? The question for me is that how do we reach a Decacon status in 5 years, right? And that is the question that I'm still trying to figure out exactly how we're going to get there. But again, if I have a crystal ball in front of me, it will be definitely the largest retail wholesale marketplace across Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore. Hopefully by then, we would have completed our launch in Philippines. We already have Vietnam and a few other places, right? And I think that's where I feel that the future of the company will be. You know, we will not start being a unicorn, right? We will definitely have to be at least a decacorn over the next 5 years, if not less. That's the only thing that I want to do. And for us, it's about taking steps to reach that over the next few years.
That's great. We go into the quick fire round. So I'll ask a question and then you just reply with short, snappy answers. Why is a leader or CEO that you look up to?
A leader, a CEO that I look up to, I think Lee Kuan Yew.
That's great. Many people share the same. Thoughts on EV car adoption in Southeast Asia? Maybe starting with Singapore and moving to the region.
I think that Singapore will definitely be one of the earliest adopters, primarily because we are a small country, so to speak. So from an infrastructure standpoint, you'll be there. I think the EV car adoption in places like Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia will be slower to come, especially in places like Indonesia and Thailand, whereby the infrastructure physically has challenges. That said, I do foresee that there will be a lot of government incentives across the various regions as the various governments intend to spur the growth of EV fleets amongst their own population of cars. I also think that at the end of the day, Tesla may not be the only company that matters in the EV race. I think, you know, Toyota, for that matter, Volkswagen, Volvo, and a whole bunch of them are not sitting ducks, right? They will do something, and we will see a very, very, very robust EV market in the next 2 to 3 years. But if you talk about mass adoption, if you talk about things like when can we expect EV to be commonplace and stuff like that, I think that's at least 5 to 10 years away.
That's great. Best advice for early stage founders raising their first round?
Best advice for early stage founders raising your first round is that please don't get screwed. trying to give too much of a company away, that's all.
Oh, that's great advice. Biggest misconception founders have about scaling a company in Southeast Asia?
They think that raising a lot of money is everything.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's a misconception by itself. Sometimes over-raising itself is an issue for you. It's a boom, right? Rather than a boom, so to speak.
Okay. I kind of know the answer to this one, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Go to activity to de-stress.
My go-to activity to de-stress, believe it or not, is programming. but yeah, either driving or programming, those are two things that I do. And I still do both of them quite regularly.
Oh, I was guessing the answer was walking in the forest, but okay, I guess wrong. anything you'd like to share to our listeners or potential customers of Caro about updates on Caro specifically?
I think you should watch out over the next couple of months, 2-3 months, you know, we should have a massive announcement coming up soon. But let's just say that we are super excited about growing the company at least, you know, 2 to 3 times at least over the next few years. I mean, over the next year itself.
That's great. We added this question. Anything you'd like to ask me?
Yeah, I have a lot of things to ask you, but why don't we start with a simple question, which is, what do you think about specs?
That's a great one. Lots of conversation about it. The simple answer is actually spec is not a new concept. It's a form of reverse M&A. It's a form of reverse mergers. 5-10 years ago, reputationally, it wasn't that great, but I think it's more commonly accepted now. There's been a spate of specs in the US, which is quite interesting because a lot of them are reaching the 12 to 24 months mark and they are looking for targets. And it turns out that actually Southeast Asia has quite, I would say, a lot of targets, but I think plausible targets that are good hunting grounds for some of these US specs. And we see them actively coming to the region. There's some pros and cons. I think the cons, I guess, is that you may not get the publicity or the roadshow marketing effect that you get in a traditional IPO. But the good thing is that instead of doing 400 meetings, you might get done with 30 meetings. You can showcase your future projections. I think that it allows, for some of our portfolio companies, it does allow a path to exit. But I would also be cautious on the front that, hey, you know, after going public, you still have to run a public company. I think for companies that are still sort of in the experimental stage, you know, going through a spec may or may not be the best option. But I think certainly a worthy option for some of our companies to consider. So on that note, hey, thanks, Aaron, for catching up with us on our show. It's been amazing to see how Caro has grown over the past few years. And it's been an honor to work with you and definitely excited to see where Caro goes in the next 5 years.
That was good. Thanks for having me. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Stay on the line with us for more conversations with our founders and investors in the region. Until our next call, I am Paolo Aquino, and this has been On Call with Insignia Ventures.